from 10,000 villages in downtown Champaign, and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, offering ground and whole bean coffee purchased from farmers using internationally recognized fair trade standards. Today's programming is made possible in part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sport shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Travis Stansel, and Henry Frayne is at the controls. Just let me tell you quickly that tomorrow morning on the program, in hour number one, we'll be talking with David Shipler. He's former New York Times correspondent, winner of the Pulitzer Prize for his writing. We'll talk about a recent book that he has authored entitled The Working Poor, Invisible in America. That's hour one. Hour two, something of a practical nature that we try to do occasionally on the show. We welcome back Rick Karch. He's an auto mechanic, has a business in Champaign. It's called Rick's Automotive Service. And we invite people to call in with questions about cars. And if you're having some problem with your car, you're not quite sure what the cause is, if you will describe the make and the model and the symptoms, he will see if he can do a diagnosis. He's been with us for many years, several times a year, and he's pretty good at that. So that's what we'll be doing tomorrow morning in the second part of the show. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, and we have 10 different topics every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. In this hour of the show, we have with us a rather distinguished British scientist who is visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. His name is Sir John Murig Thomas. He is honorary professor of solid-state chemistry at University of Cambridge. He's also emeritus professor of chemistry at the Royal Institution of Great Britain. He was formerly master of Peterhouse, the oldest college in the University of Cambridge. He is here visiting to give a talk in the MillerCom series about the unpredictability of science and its consequences. This afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Levis Center on the U of I campus, sponsored by a long list of departments, including the School of Chemical Sciences. We're glad to have him here and appreciate the fact that he's giving us some of his time. And for people who are listening, by the way, if you have questions, comments, you can certainly pick up the telephone and give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
As I understand it, the premise of the talk is goes something like this. As you probably would expect that if you're going to engage people in the conversation about the future direction of science research and technology, you would think that scientists would be well-positioned or better positioned than your average person to answer that question. That is, where is your research going? What do you think will be its practical applications? What will be happening in the next few years? And I guess, as it turns out, that scientists really are no better than your average person at answering a question like
that's
that.
That's precisely my point. And it's a bit surprising when you contemplate this fact that even the top scientists in the world don't usually get it right when they look beyond 3 or 4 or 10 years, even in their own subjects. And I'm going to give many illustrations of that. It's an astonishing fact because, after all, science rules many facets of our lives, and it's very important, therefore, to know what's likely to be ahead of us in the future. I mean, governments want to know this, business people want to know it, the man in the street wants to know it. One of the examples I shall give in my talk this afternoon is what President Roosevelt did in 1937. He set up a commission collecting the good and the best, as it were, in the nation and asked them to come to a consensus opinion as to what likely developments there were to be expected in the next 20 years or so. And the remarkable thing is how wrong they were. You know, they said certain things which ultimately came to be true, but they missed so many, many things. Now, some things you can't blame them for missing. For example, totally new discoveries. I mean, nuclear fission could hardly have been predicted in 1930. Discovery was made in 1938-39. So you can't hold it against a body of experts that they missed that. But quite apart from that, there were things already latent in society, in science, in technology, that weren't actually thought of as being highly important. I mean, I'll just give one example now. What I don't wish to do in this broadcast is to give you my
lecture. To give the talk. No, that's quite understandable.
Let me give you one example. The fuel cell. The fuel cell was invented, conceived, demonstrated in 1842 by a fellow countryman of mine, Sir William Grove from Wales. He was a lawyer, incidentally, but he had a great interest in science. And he was very excited when he wrote to Michael Faraday and said, look, this is a remarkable achievement. I can put hydrogen and oxygen together, and they don't explode in the presence of a catalyst the way I'm putting them to work. I generate electricity from it, and this is really rather interesting. Now, that was known. None of the people in Washington or in the United States or anywhere else in the world thought that that might be important. You can't go anywhere these days in the civilized world without hearing the intense effort that's being spent here on this campus. I mean, in fact, yesterday in the Department of Chemistry and Chemical Engineering, I saw a very beautiful account of how a fuel cell has been developed here in Urbana, Illinois, which will enable you to drive your future mobile phone. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, and that's the way it's going to go. Now, it is fascinating, and of course, everybody knows that there's an element of chance, you know, discoveries by chance. Now, that is, of course, a factor that you have to outline and illustrate, and I shall do that this evening. But there are many other aspects of this whole unpredictability that are worth pondering. When groups of experts come out and say, no, this is what's going to happen, or this is impossible, and yet you find that they were both wrong. It's not simply an intellectual exercise, fascinating as it is. It also, of course, depends greatly, I mean, it influences greatly, rather, the way in which public expenditure of funds or private expenditure of funds goes. Mm-hmm. I sat on a government committee in Britain, the Cabinet Office Committee, for 4 years, from 1982 to 86, and one of the jobs we had was to identify promising areas of science. We listed in our report of 1985 about 20 such promising areas, only two of which are now really valid: magnetic resonance imaging and unconventional methods of microscopy. So that's really what I'm going to be talking about this evening. And I try to draw examples from medicine, from astronomy, from physics, from all aspects of science, pure and applied.
Well, I appreciate your not wanting to give the talk here and then give it again this afternoon. But I certainly am curious, and I'm sure that a lot of people listening would be curious, to hear a little bit about why it is that it is as it is. I mean, when you get a bunch of learned people together, even people in their own fields, you get a bunch of chemists together, and you're a chemist, and say, well, you know, you tell me what you think are going to be the big developments in chemistry. That even they, it's not just a case of asking them about what's going to happen in biology. You ask them what's going to happen in chemistry, and the same thing happens. I mean, that seems sort of odd.
It's a very fair question, and I'm glad you're persisting on that. In the college to which I belonged in Cambridge, still do, as a matter of fact, Peterhouse, there were two Nobel Prize winners. They won the Nobel Prize in 1962. Sir John Kendrew and Max Perutz. They were the men that really showed how to determine the structure of complicated proteins and hemoglobin and myoglobin. And they were the founders, really, of molecular biology in Britain to a large extent. Now, they could never have foreseen, I mean, I was very friendly with both of them, that a chance discovery in the University of Leicester by a man named Alec Jeffries unraveled completely, or exposed completely, the reality of genetic fingerprinting. You see, this was a chance discovery. But you had to know something about DNA, you had to know about the gene sequence and so forth, the way in which molecular biology gradually unfolded. suddenly you realize, goodness me, we can identify every human being or every living thing on Earth from its genetic fingerprint. Devastating fact, isn't it? It's not just fingerprinting. You know, you can't take a fingerprint of a bacterium or a frog, but you can, by looking at its DNA, tell exactly what it is. It's really unpredictable. And in fact, it was John Kendrew in the book that he wrote, The Thread of Life, after he won the Nobel Prize, which set me thinking on this theme of even scientists who are expert in their fields find it very difficult to look beyond 3 or 4 years. Mm. I shall start my lecture this evening by recalling what Lord Rutherford said in New York City in 1933, in which he effectively said that, you know, anybody who believes that you can get energy out of the nucleus of an atom is talking nonsense. And, well, you know the rest. It's history, as they say.
I think that if you ask, start asking people who've thought about the question, what's the essence of creativity? I think that they will say something like, when you look at people who have been groundbreaking individuals in whatever their field, you will see that they are able to look at the world and see it differently than other people, and to take take ideas and put them together in novel ways that lead to new kinds of understanding that other people simply don't do.
Absolutely right. And the classic example there is Isaac Newton. You know, Isaac Newton, just imagine, here's this man. He's the son of an illiterate yeoman farmer from Lincolnshire in England. He's a very smart young man, extremely clever. And he wants to try and understand quantitatively how he can describe the process of change in the physical world, dropping of an apple, the throwing of a projectile or whatever. Ultimately, he formulates the laws of motion, and he invents calculus. He invents it. Now, a towering genius. From that day onwards, mankind scientifically lived differently. I mean, Leibniz came along and he independently discovered calculus. But now you could predict the ebb and flow of the tide, ultimately, through Newton's laws. You could predict solar and lunar eclipses. You could predict the path of a projectile and a satellite and so forth. But over and above that, you've raised a very interesting question about these individuals who are blessed with that ability to perceive and conceive things that others don't usually have. There's another factor which I think is extremely important, and this comes down to the question of technique and tools. Take Galileo, you see. I mean, by building a telescope, he changed forever, not just our knowledge of the external world, to see things, to see new moons, and to see things on the moon, and spots on the sun, and so forth. But in addition, it caused a revolution in the thinking about man's place in the cosmos and in the universe. Mm-hmm. So technique as well as great individuals. And these are two points that we've now mentioned, which I shall also be developing this evening and illustrating further.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. I should introduce again our guest. Sir John Murig Thomas is Honorary Professor of Solid State Chemistry and former Master of Peterhouse at the University of Cambridge. He is also Emeritus Professor at the Royal Institution, and he is here to talk on this very subject, the unpredictability of science and its consequences, this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Levis Faculty Center. This is a lecture that's being held in conjunction with the Drickhammer Symposium, honoring Harry George Drickhammer, pioneer in high-pressure studies of condensed matter, professor of chemical engineering, chemistry, and physics at University of Illinois for 56 years. Questions here, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I have a caller in Champaign to talk with here, line one.
Hello. I'm interested in education and societal thinking in the directions that, say, for example, American society is going. And so I want to ask you about science and, quote, knowledge in quotations. and point to two movements, for example, postmodernism, which seems to question narratives and metaphors used by science, and then maybe another movement that I'm characterizing or caricaturing, which would reject science, or maybe it's a kind of obscurantism, a return to rejection, or a return to revelation as literal. And I'm wondering how you see the need for scientific education in the U.S. or the West, and our capacity to question it, and our question our ways of thinking, or, you know, look at science, look at philosophy, look at linguistics. On the one hand, you know, there is mystery and chance. And on the other hand, well, personally, I don't think that we should revert to anti-scientific approaches.
So. Well, I certainly agree with you that I think it would be taking a step backward, and a major step backward, if you rejected entirely the idea that you'd need science. I mean, science is not just the language of modern society. Science enables us to build modern society. Science enables us to make people healthy, to live longer. And to do all sorts of things, to communicate better. I mean, the mere fact that you and I are talking in this way is attributable to scientific progress. So, I mean, whilst I accept the reality of the tendency that there is these days, in some cases, as you put it earlier in your question, to reject science, I think it's a profoundly mistaken view. I mean, you can't reject science more than I would reject religion, more than I would reject many other aspects of life, because they're an essential part of life. But, I mean, knowledge, if you accept that mankind, and men and women in general, are thinking beings, it's inevitable that knowledge will accumulate, and that knowledge is... It manifests itself in a multiplicity of different ways. Sometimes it can be deeply psychological. Sometimes it can be in the form entirely of metaphor. It can be expressed through literature very effectively, as we've seen, through music. It's also a part of the entirety of the human existence that it comes through scientific inquiry. Now, there may be limitations to scientific inquiry, but, I mean, that is a valid study in itself, but I don't think that one should question the very idea that science is capable of revelation. I think it's demonstrably true that revelation has come in leaps and bounds through scientific inquiry. Knowledge is power, as Francis Bacon said in the 17th century. And, you know, one needs to have an understanding of the entire world in which we live. And that, effectively, is what the adventure of science is about.
And do you think there are any limits to be put on science, or any ways or structures or systems to go about limiting scientific endeavors?
Well, I respond to your question in two ways. I mean, I can certainly concede that the scientific method may not be universally applicable to every conceivable aspect of the human adventure or the human endeavor. I mean, there are instances where, as a scientist, you feel that even the profundity of scientific technique and concept is not quite enough to account for the unity and wholeness of human life. I mean, you know, there are debates as to whether there is a limit to scientific description of the world in which we live. I personally think that, you know, given the power of science, I don't think you can explain every aspect of human existence solely in terms of science. And then the other aspect of your question is, should you impose some limits on it? I mean, should you stop people from inquiring into, say, genetic manipulation, for example? this is a thorny question, and it's one that has to be handled with extreme care. Certainly one has to be extremely careful and mustn't allow random and irresponsible experimentation, which is not governed, as it were, by groups of experts, imperfect as they may be, from what I said earlier, because experts don't know everything. I do think that one needs to be exercising some caution in allowing certain types of experiments to be carried out, and I think that most people in society would accept that.
Thank you very much.
Right, thank you. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let me ask you about another criticism that is sometimes leveled at science. Within individual fields, on the key questions, there is often a consensus, and consensus may in fact be the wrong word, because the weight of opinion backed by research is on one particular conclusion. The criticism that's often made, though, is that someone comes along with a radically different take on the same question. And some people would point out, well, you know, the scientific enterprise is always supposed to be questioning. You are always supposed to be able to question what it is you think that you know. That's the whole point. But that, in fact, one particular idea can become so solidly entrenched, and a lot of people, they have interest in their careers and their funding are based on that particular way of approaching it. So that if somebody else comes along and says, well, you know, I think maybe we've been completely wrong about this, and the explanation lies somewhere else, that person is not going to be terribly popular in the field. And some people would say, in fact, that they have a hard time getting a fair hearing for their ideas. And that it may be, if we're, you know, going back to this question of why it is that often scientists aren't very good at predicting the future, it is because they're too wedded to the ideas of the present.
Well, I think all of what you said is perfectly valid. And indeed, I have a very nice example, which I shall expatiate upon this afternoon, of a very interesting instance in Australia when a doctor, a house doctor at a hospital, was absolutely convinced that the entire medical profession were wrong in the causes of gastroduodenal ulcers and so forth. You know, I mean, this was 1982, and he was absolutely convinced, he'd convinced himself, that the prevailing dogma was just mistaken. Nobody believed him, but he persisted, and he ultimately proved himself to be right. The way in which we now treat duodenal ulcers is influenced far more by his work than what it was by the experts of 40 years ago. So, you know, it's true, some individuals get a very hard time. I mean, there's a great story of a British Nobel Prize winner in chemistry. He died about 10 years ago, Peter Mitchell. He was of the opinion that the nature of the way in which energy is sort of transmitted throughout living things is not so much electrical, but based on protons, on hydrogen plus ions. And he had a devil of his of the job to convince the world. It took him about 25 years to be sort of getting into the position where his views ultimately received respectability and was finally applauded with the highest accolade.
Well, I'm assuming that you're referring, with the man in the ulcer story, you're referring to the what now has become our understanding that these kinds of ulcers are primarily caused by a bacteria.
That's right.
The H. pylori,
that's
and
right.
That we're actually now starting to treat people who have ulcers once it has been established that the bacterium is present, and that's really what's going on. We're giving them antibiotics, and that's completely different from the kind of treatment that we used to do.
Yeah.
So that serves as one example where one man came along and challenged the conventional wisdom and turned out to be right. I guess, though, how often really does it happen that the conventional wisdom is wrong? I mean, we have to say, yes, there are cases in which it is, but I would imagine that there are other cases, and I don't know, maybe more cases, where someone has come along and challenged the conventional wisdom, and it turns out, well, they were wrong, that the conventional wisdom was right.
Yeah, I think it would be a mistake to assume, you see, that because there is a conventional wisdom, that then there's a conspiracy to hold down anyone else who wants to challenge that. I mean, that's unlikely. You did, however, mention that, I mean, some people are wedded to certain conventional views because their careers and all sorts of other things are dependent upon it. And that is a subtle and subterranean cause, as it were, for their supporting that view. But, I mean, in an open society, and thank goodness one lives in an open society, I mean, one's got to give complete freedom of thought and freedom of contemplation and challenging. The very nature of science is based on challenge. You know, it grows that way. It is not a dogma. You know, truth wins out. In science, it always is the question of, well, what are the experimental facts? I mean, one of my heroes and one of my distant predecessors was Michael Faraday. There was a time when Michael Faraday, in 1849, convinced himself, having shown that there was a relationship between magnetism and light, magneto-optics became a reality, and we use it now, having shown there was a link between electricity and magnetism, electromagnetism is a reality, he grew convinced that there was a direct link between gravity and electricity. And one day, writing in his notebook, you see, he never published this, he realized that it might be true that when you sort of drop a heavy mass through a gravitational field, you might be able to generate electricity. Now, we know that that is not the case. He began to almost romanticize. And what he wrote down was, all this is a dream. Nothing is too wonderful to be true if it be consistent with the laws of nature. And in such things as these, experiment is the best test of such consistency. So, I mean, that's the very way in which science grows. So challenge is absolutely central to the scientific experience and the scientific adventure. So you're quite right.
Let's talk with someone else. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Did you say line one?
Yes.
You were staticky right when you said the number. I have a question which you may not want to answer, but I would like to ask it anyway. It has to do with public policy. Many people would argue that while our space program provides masses of invaluable information about the planets, the stars, the physics, cosmology, etc., given our current situation in terms of, let's say, healthcare, that it's an unwise expenditure of money because we have so many other scientific questions that are more pressing. The argument comes back, but if we didn't have these kinds of investments in the space program, we wouldn't have, and then a whole list of advances comes out, unanticipated and unexpected advances that came out of the space program, for example, in material science. My question to you is, irrespective of your own feelings about space programs, would a certain amount of money that is devoted to, say, space or anything else, if it were devoted solely, let's say, to biological research or medical research, would it not provide even more benefits? There might not be the same unexpected benefits that sort of come serendipitously out of a space program, but would you not, in the long run, get more benefits to society by devoting that directly to applicable research?
Well, that's a very fair question, and it's one that's asked very frequently, and I have every sympathy with you for putting it, actually. Now, I can't tell you, of course, whether if one were to sort of switch the funding from, shall we say, astronomy and the space program into biology, whether the net outcome in a certain period of time would be far better to mankind. You can't tell this. But public policy decisions in an open society, in a civilized society, have got to always resort to the question of balance. You know, there's got to be some sum of money, S-U-M, sum of money, set aside to look at fundamental things, to look at the cosmos, to look at the outside world. It's almost, you know, scientific heresy not to question the nature of the world in which we find ourselves. And it really does make sense, I believe, to put a certain amount of our funds into efforts to explore the cosmos. It's all a question of balance. And you know, when one is at war, and when one is in a state of crisis, and we've lived through periods of crises, most of the people who are alive now, there has to be constant reassessment of how you distribute your funding so as to support fundamental research, so as to support research that's more likely to be mission-oriented to give you immediate rewards. I mean, in the First World War in Britain, during that period and shortly thereafter, it became so apparent that deaths from tuberculosis, from all sorts of other diseases, were so very, very large in number that something fundamental had to be done, and the Medical Research Council was set up in order to give a scientific basis for clinical medicine. And that was, you know, if you like, an example of using biological research and putting money from the government into that area to support such endeavors. That's continued. There's always a debate in Britain, and there is in America, I know about this, you know, the super collider argument and so forth. I mean, should that have gone on? Or should you, as for example, be spending huge sums of money, as there is being done in Europe at present, on high-temperature fusion when the prospects are that it's not going to yield anything for another 10 years? It consumes huge sums of money. And there is a very understandable and vociferous fraction of the public who say, well, look, put that money into more immediate things that we can do in healthcare and so forth. So I do want to try and answer your question. It's a difficult one to answer. But in short, I would say that it's constant reassessment. And that's why it's good that there are occasionally change of governments, change of individuals, change of people who are in committees that make these decisions. And their voices have to be heard. And it's all a question of balance of opportunities.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks. And again, other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest, Sir John Murig-Thomas. He is Honorary Professor of Solid-State Chemistry at University of Cambridge and Emeritus Professor of Chemistry at the Royal Institution of Great Britain in London. Formerly, he was the Master of Peterhouse, the oldest college in University of Cambridge. And he is here visiting the campus to talk about some of these issues. He'll be giving a talk in the MillerCom series about the unpredictability of science and its consequences. That's this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Levis Center. And, of course, anyone's welcome to attend. And questions here, welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. There is some... to me, at least, I guess a basic way of thinking in science. At least, this is my understanding that within science, one should always question what one knows or what one thinks one knows. You do an experiment 100 times, but the 101st, it may not turn out the same way, which causes you to question your very basic ideas. And that perhaps maybe gets difficult after a while if you do an experiment 1,000 times. Maybe you think, well, 1,001, it's going to turn out the same. But I guess the idea that I have is that it's that there always you have to reserve in the back of your mind a spot for the idea that you could be what you think today based on everything you know, all the experiments you've done, all the hard thinking you've done. What you know today might in fact be wrong. And I think actually that for people who are not scientists, they see this as a weakness or a flaw in science.
Well, I accept the sentiments that lie behind your question, but, I mean, fundamentally, science progresses on the premise that proof by repetition is the essence of the method of progress. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're never going to proclaim a discovery just by one experiment. You repeat it, and you repeat it numerous times under all sorts of conditions until you're convinced that this really does work. You know, I mean, again, I go back to Michael Faraday. He had been preoccupied with the idea for about 20 years that there might be a link somehow, somewhere, between magnetism and electricity. And finally, on one day in 1831, he realized that if you plunged a magnet into a coil of metal and had a meter attached to that coil and pulled it out again, every time you plunged the magnet in, there was a kick on the galvanometer. Every time you pulled it out, there was a kick in the opposite direction. Now, he repeated that numerous times. And that was the discovery of electromagnetic induction. And you could repeat that 1,000,000,000 times, and it works. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's reached the state of an established truth, as it were. Every person who tries that anywhere on Earth, it's independent of the racial nature of the individual doing the experiment or the geographical location. Mm-hmm. That is an established scientific fact. And indeed, the majority of scientific truths are in that of that kind. I mean, where there's uncertainty, you can't honestly claim that it is as yet an established chemical truth by definition.
So, well, maybe there what I'm doing is I am confusing or blurring those things that can be tested by an experiment,
right,
and have been.
Right.
And then those things that, at least as yet, we have not devised experiments to test.
Exactly. Look, there was a wonderful Italian gentleman named Avogadro, I suppose everybody...
The man with the number.
The man with the number. But you know what he said in 1811? Just imagine yourself meeting Amedeo Avogadro, and he would say to you, take this situation, you'd say. If you have equal volumes of all gases under the same conditions of temperature and pressure, they contain the same number of molecules. Now, if somebody told you that, even now, you'd say, this man is a madman, you know. But he was right. Now it is a hypothesis. Mm. Nobody believed him at the time. John Dalton didn't believe him. Michael Faraday didn't believe him. It was 1860 before people began to think that that might be true. And now it is a universal truth, and we, as you say, call it Avogadro's number. So that's an example of the situation that you've prompted me to recall. Hmm. Mm.
Let's talk with another caller, someone in Indiana, I believe. You're line number 4. Hello. Yes.
I'd like to shift the unpredictability just a bit, mainly just to get your experience on these kind of things. I'm sure you've seen before, and I'm talking about the Bush administration pulling the rug or whatever out from underneath the telescope to put the $200 million worth of new equipment up in it so we can see further into space. I just wonder if you come across those things before that were outside private organizations or basically maybe public governments all of a sudden shift policy, and what that does in terms of advancement or whatever of science.
I'm not quite sure if I understand your question there, really. I mean, I know the reality of the situation, that the Bush administration has said that it's wanting to divert sums of money now to make manned space flights and so on, and therefore that the future of the Hubble Space Telescope is very much under a huge question mark, and I personally regret that. That's my own opinion, because the Hubble Space Telescope has been probably one of the most conspicuous experimental successes ever. Mm. I mean, what it's taught us about the nature of the cosmos again, I shall be mentioning something about this in my talk. I mean, we now, compared with just 10 years ago, the known dimensions of the universe have increased by a factor of 1,000 compared with what we knew or thought we knew 10 years ago. That's an astonishing fact when you think about it, and it's attributable entirely to the Hubble Space Telescope and some of the instruments and the techniques, which I was mentioning earlier in answer to the question put to me by my interviewer, that were on board that telescope. So I don't really know what my position is in regard to the question that you've posed. I certainly feel that it's regretful that this conspicuous success, which looks as if it can yield even greater success, I mean, you know, already we've understood that there is a mysterious, puzzling, enigmatic, dark energy, as it's called, in the universe. You know, there's almost an anti-gravity at work. I mean, the universe is expanding. It's expanding faster than it should be expanding, based on our earlier presuppositions. That is in itself intriguing and fundamentally important, and could well lead to a new understanding of the nature of natural forces. Mm.
I think that you know, a lot of people have looked at the president's proposal to go back to the moon and then to Mars and say they're not really quite sure why it is that he proposed that. The continued commitment to build the International Space Station, there, that seems to be a little bit more clear, at least that scientists will say that it's part of our learning about what happens to humans when they spend a long time in space, and that there may also be some commercial considerations there as well. And I guess perhaps the question that the caller is asking is has to do with either political motivations driving scientific research or commercial ones. And I guess, though, I wonder whether, in fact, there's anything new about that, or the funding in the direction of scientific research has always been driven in some respect by political and commercial concerns.
That's right. Yeah, that's true. I mean, political decisions. I mentioned earlier the setting up of the Medical Research Council in Britain. That was a political decision. It was the Chancellor of the Exchequer first and then the Prime Minister in Britain who said, look, we've got to do this. And it was very altruistic, but it was a political decision. Money had to be spent to set up a funding, a public body, namely the Medical Research Council, to cater for the illnesses, to conquer the illnesses, to master disease and so forth, and to improve the well-being and the expectation of life at birth of the nation. And political decisions are really, I mean, they have to be made, and they have a scientific interconnection. I mean, no doubt about that.
Another caller in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, during the talk, about a year ago, my wife and I got to London for the first time, and we were surprised to find that the Royal Institution isn't as stuffy as I would have imagined. They actually let us sit in on one of the lectures, even though we got up in the nosebleed section of the auditorium. But it was pretty impressive. A lot of people were walking around in formal dress, and we were just tourists. So, but I thought that was really nice that they did that. Reason I called though is about. I don't know if you're aware, but the Wall Street Journal pretty much agrees with you as well. There was a piece in the Wall Street Journal entitled "Uncertainty is an Essential Ingredient of Progress," where they mention that futurists, to quote a couple lines from it, they go, "Futurists imagined electric lighting, but no electric guitars, supersonic jets, but no hang gliders, laser weapons, but no laser surgery or compact discs, government surveillance cameras, but no baby monitors." And they quote as a one of the sources of the understanding that of this uncertainty is a political scientist called Aaron Wildavsky, who taught at the University of California, Berkeley. And they quote him as saying, "Incessant search by many minds produces more and more valuable knowledge than the attempt to program the paths to discovery by a single one," unquote. And, you know, they're arguing for the kind of freedom that they embody in, like, ideas of laissez-faire and such. So I thought you might enjoy hearing about that.
I do, yes. I'm very interested.
So, but I do have a kind of a question, and I'll just, and it's close to what everybody else has been asking you, but I was just curious, as you kind of survey the scene, do you think planning is too close? Can you identify an area where you think planning is too close and where there isn't enough, allowed freedom in any of the areas that you're familiar with?
You raise a very interesting question. Look, I wouldn't wish to give the impression that I'm against planning of all kinds. I mean, I'm an active research, laboratory-oriented scientist, and I plan my experiments, and I try to plan my program of activities for the next year or two. Not much beyond that, because of what I've said earlier. And you've got to have that. I mean, you know, research companies, the IBMs and the Bell Labs, or the former Bell Labs and government laboratories, they have to have a program of research. It mustn't be too rigidified, however. What one has to do, in my opinion, is to make sure that you recruit outstandingly able people and give them intellectual freedom, remind them periodically what your main goals are. Main goals, and let them get on with it. Let them use the facilities. Let them devise new facilities, new techniques. I mean, the story of magnetic resonance is a fantastically interesting story, and of course, Illinois can be very proud of what it has done to be universally recognized as one of the great centers where achievements have reached the very highest level. But originally, a group of physicists began to wonder, what on earth is happening? You know, this signal from a proton is now different from what it was in the substance that I looked at yesterday. What's going on here? And then the chemists realized that the physicist had tumbled on a technique which was of immense value to them. And, I mean, the whole of the method of analytical chemistry, what one nowadays uses, is inextricably bound up with the necessity of having magnetic resonance. And magnetic resonance imaging, as we know, has transformed medicine. Almost all the major hospitals of the world have got to operate with such a thing. And that has come because of individuals who are given total freedom of intellectual endeavor.
We have just a couple of minutes left. I want to try to include one more caller in Champaign and line two.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you what you think. I mean, it's my opinion. I guess I'm going to state my opinion that that there is often a very long lag time between discovery and a paradigm shift. That science is bounded by politics, social relationships, religion. Upbringing, the sex of the investigator, so that sometimes you have discoveries that don't result in major paradigm shifts because of these factors for a very long time, and that the scientific community itself is extremely conservative, and that because of its skepticism, I guess, and because of inertia, but that paradigm shifts do occur substantially after the fact in most cases.
Well, in most cases, I think there's some truth in what you say, but it's not universally true. I mean, indeed, I totally agree that there have been instances where there's been a tremendously long induction time, so to speak, that's elapsed before you make the initial discovery of something and then apply it. But then there are other examples. Monoclonal antibodies, for example, they were sort of understood properly and handled in a sensible way by a group at the Medical Research Council in Cambridge. And it took very little time indeed to introduce those into medical practice. So, I mean, there are examples where indeed the length of time is disproportionate and unconscionable, but there are other instances, mercifully, which are not.
Do you think that modern communications has shortened those lags?
I think they have, yes, yeah. Inevitably.
Because one of the really long ones that I can think of was genetics. Modern genetics was discovered, and independently Darwinism was born. And the two weren't really brought together.
Well, this has been one of the revolutions, the consequences of the molecular biological revolution, of course, where you were able to bring in essentially molecular genetics into the understanding of evolution and so forth.
Right.
It's a beautiful illustration of it, I agree.
All right, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. We, I think, will have to leave it at that. With one last mention that our guest, Sir John Murick Thomas, will be speaking on the subject, the unpredictability of science and its consequences, as a talk in the MillerCom series. That's this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Levis Center on the U of I campus. And these talks are always free and open to the public. Anyone listening should feel welcome to stop by. We want to thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
And we appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Our broadcast today is made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, with foods from around the world. Currently, World Harvest is featuring foods from India, featuring Indian sweets, snacks, paratha, and curries, with taste samplings available. World Harvest Foods at the intersection of 6th and University in Champaign encourages you to join them in supporting Pollack Radio. Tomorrow morning on the show, in the first hour, we'll be talking with David Shipler. He's former New York Times correspondent, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. Will talk about his recent book, The Working Poor, Invisible in America. Then in hour two, if you're having trouble with your car, you can call in and talk with Rick Karch. He is an auto mechanic from Rick's Automotive Service in Champaign. And he's generally here four times a year. Every season we ask him in, and he takes your questions. So if you have a problem, call in and tell us about it, and he'll see if he can suggest a solution. That's tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings from 10 to noon every week. We have 10 shows, 10 different topics, and we always invite your calls. Right now, we hope you will stay tuned, because up next is the Afternoon Magazine, the host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll explore this question: what is lost when a language is lost? Our guest will be journalist Elizabeth C. She's a staffer at the Wall Street